of Pitts. Arguing for the appellant, Walter R. Shetley. Arguing for the appellee, Sonia P. McCullen. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Shetley and Ms. McCullen. Are you both ready to proceed today? Very well. Mr. Shetley, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. Ms. McCullen will give you a warning with 10 minutes as well. Please proceed.
All right. There are a lot of issues in this case, and I'd like to start off with the prosecutorial misconduct issue, because that's the only one that would possibly result in release of my client rather than remand. Many decades ago, when I first started practice, there was a particularly aggressive prosecutor who had a reputation that his ambition in life was to convict an innocent person with inadmissible evidence. And I'm sure this wasn't true, but it was his reputation. But in this case, I don't think that is what happened, okay? And it's based on the evidence. It's not my opinion, it's not my thought, but it's what happened. And if you look at the pictures of the car and the blood, we don't know if they're blood spots, but there are red spots that appear to be blood all over the front seat, even some into the back seat, and it's almost inconceivable that anybody who was doing the stabbing would not be covered with similar, if it's blood, would not be covered with similar spots. And when Mr. Pitts was arrested several minutes after this occurred, there were only blood spots on his jacket, no blood spots on his clothing, no blood on his face, no blood on his hands, no DNA on his hands of the victim. There was DNA on his hands of two other people, but no DNA of the victim. So based on that evidence alone, it seems pretty hard to understand how he could have possibly been the attacker. Based on that. Now so all we have basically against that is the ID of the victim. And the victim's ID, of course, is completely and totally at odds with what he told the grand jury. And he told the grand jury that all he could see was a silhouette of his attacker. He wasn't looking at his attacker when he got struck on the first side. On the right-hand side, he wasn't looking at his attacker when he got struck on the left-hand side. Then he turned and he raised his arm, so that was blocking his view. And when he got, whatever he saw was only a silhouette in the darkness. Now, when he gets into court, he testifies, yes, I saw him directly, looked into his face. I could see him, Joseph Pitts. There was plenty of light coming from the open door. And then the curious part is he asks the prosecutor to come up and do a demonstration. Now, I mean, that's just completely, off the wall.
Mr. Shetley, was he cross-examined on his previous inconsistent statement?
We had a guy doing his pro se. it's very unfortunate that Mr. Pitts did not have counsel that was competent of handling these matters, and he was doing it pro se, and I know he could have cross-examined, yes, and if he had, the grand jury didn't get any cross-examination in the grand jury either, but when the grand jury was looking at it, they were very concerned that maybe this was somebody else, not Mr. Pitts, because of the weakness of that identification. And the prosecutor in their answering brief says, Mr. Pitts invented the defense based on his review of the evidence and testimonies. That he made it all up because but he had a chance to see it, okay? But the grand jury saw the same evidence. Well, actually, the petty jury didn't see the evidence from that the grand jury saw, but it's still evidence.
Even if it is proper for, I shouldn't even say even, but was there any evidence to suggest that he had reviewed the police reports?
Yeah, well.
And therefore,
yeah,
that's where his defense came from?
Yeah, well, you're right. I don't think there was, but that's it. Yeah, it was kind of an assumption, yeah.
But even if you could, even if they knew that, is that a proper thing to say?
No, that was our point, yeah. Now that I was in a denial of his right to do that. I mean, his constitutional right is to review the evidence and see the evidence and be present in court while it's being presented.
What in the statement of the prosecutor did the prosecutor say he was present in court?
No, they didn't say that specifically, yeah. But it's the same thing. They say he had the opportunity to view the evidence.
After looking at all the facts, after looking at the police reports,
yeah,
and the evidence that's in this case, the defendant comes up with that one,
yeah,
idea.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
How is that a comment on his right to be present at his trial?
Reviewing the evidence that's in the court, right?
And looking at the police report.
Yeah. Looking at the police report. But like Justice Pollack said, you know, that wasn't even any evidence of that. But the only evidence of the evidence that he saw was what he saw in court.
But aren't there situations where if the prosecutor is commenting on very specific things that came out during the course of the trial, that type of commentary can be acceptable? That was the Mattson case, right, as opposed to Walsh. Which is this fit in? The specific types of commentary or the generic, just he's here at trial and that's, so he was able to tailor?
I'm saying there wasn't any tailoring. I mean, if you look at the evidence that was presented to the grand jury, that is, I mean, that just pops out. There's no tailoring. I mean, the grand jury themselves asked Mr. Brown, are you, you know, sure it wasn't somebody else? Yeah? They thought it might possibly have been because it was dark and all he saw was a silhouette. So it could quite possibly have been somebody else. Now,
isn't this also problem? I mean, it's the Chief Justice just asked you, is this, you know, Walsh or Mattson? I mean, that's one kind of problem because it said, you know, the person got to review the evidence. But this seems to be, in some ways, maybe even more problematic than those two cases because here they're actually denigrating and penalizing the defendant for exercising a constitutional right to prepare for trial,
yes,
viewing plea reports. I mean,
yes,
that could be utilized against every single defendant.
Yes.
The government could stand up, well, you know, they got to look at the police reports in this case.
Yeah. I think, well, I agree.
Mr. Shetley, could, yeah, you talk a bit about the opening of the bag with the pants in there? Because as you pointed out, the question of whether there is blood on the defendant or not was a central issue in this case. And what is your argument with regard to it being a potential juror misconduct for the jurors to have opened that bag to look at the,
yeah,
pants?
It's not, the bag was open. At least that's what the jury communication said. They didn't. It wasn't a question of scissors, okay? That there was a big to-do about scissors. You want to open the bag, but
it was sent back in an open bag, is your
understanding? It was in an open. Well, that's what the jury communication says. Okay, we want gloves. They wanted gloves. They didn't say they wanted scissors. They said they wanted gloves, so that they could examine the pants. Okay, and the misconduct that I'm alleging is not examining the pants. And that the misconduct is assuming that those spots inside the pants were blood, and then assuming that the blood was Mr. Brown's blood.
Now, how do we know that without running afoul of Rule 806B?
Yeah, because we know from Ms. Ochoa's testimony that after they looked at the pants, three of the four jurors changed their votes. And we know that this occurred within a few, a very short period of time.
So would you agree we should not give weight to the actual testimony about what they discussed or how that affected their deliberations?
Well, but that's part of the, that's something that she could testify about.
Well, what they discussed is admissible, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
We can consider what they discussed.
What happened?
We cannot consider what the impact was of that.
We can't talk about what she thought
right.
and the reason why she changed her vote. But
because if a juror comes into the jury room and says, I just found out that this defendant has committed murder before,
yeah.
that can be considered juror misconduct. Yeah. What they said in and of itself is misconduct, correct?
Right. Yes. Yes, and the fact that they looked at the spots and they changed their votes and it was very quick is I think from that you can conclude that was the reason why they.
In other words, a juror became a witness, and a juror became an expert witness without being qualified.
An expert witness to say that this is blood, but this is the blood of. Brown, Jason Brown, and the fact that it's on the inside of the pants, I mean, that makes it kind of really hard to swallow that it was from the attack. It was if it's on the inside of your pants, it's probably your own blood, right?
So, but now, how does it? You know, is that the kind of issue that Rule 606 envisions we would be looking into? I mean, typically. So you think we can get there without running afoul of that rule? That's my question.
The rule says that you can't look at her testimony that she says, I changed my vote because they were shouting at me. That's I think, the commentary to the rule specifically says that. She can't talk about what's going on inside her head or somebody else's head, but she can testify as to what happened. Huh? And she did testify. But she did say the reason I changed my vote was because they were shouting at me and they wanted to go home. But so
is this any different than Williamson, where a juror testifies or they find a dictionary here that the juror testifies, look, we were looking for blood. She testifies, and as Justice McKenna, you can consider what they said. They were looking for blood, and they find three spots.
Yeah. Right. Three brownish red.
And that's what
spots.
They were looking for.
Yeah.
The whole case centered, in fact, on whether or not, I mean, the defendant's closing argument talks about there would be blood on
blood. Like he couldn't have, if he had been the attacker, he would have been covered with blood. I mean, you have to look at those pictures of the car. You have to look at those pictures. And there's blood spots. I mean, I can't say blood spot. There's brownish red spots all over the car. Now the police didn't even test them. Okay, the only spots that they tested was a few spots, but they didn't test the spots all over. I mean, they very well could have found the blood of the attacker if they had tested more spots in the blood in the car. But if you look at the pictures, there's something that looks like blood. All over the car, and if it is blood, the person that was doing the oath, and then they bring in this expert testimony to say, oh, the way he was sitting, the blood didn't gush out.
Mr. Shetley, when you're focusing on the evidence of blood and the significance of that evidence to the juror, I wanted to ask you how you interpret the record. Specifically, I'm going to ask you whether you think the record establishes that the juror was affected by this viewing of the pants and seeing the spots. And let me refer you to the statement that was made by her. This is juror being asked, do you believe or did you see any stains on the pants, just small drops? And they determined that it must be blood. And you're saying then there's an objection going into the deliberative process. But when the juror is explaining that result of seeing these drops, the court says, You can ask her if she had a conclusion. I'll allow that because I don't think it skirts 606B, but I think it's within the realm of what I'm going to allow. So she gets to state her conclusion, it would seem, from what the judge says. But I wanted to ask you, what is your interpretation of the record as to what her conclusion was after seeing the spots?
I'm thinking that you don't need to be concerned about her conclusion because you can just take her testimony that there were four jurors who were voting not guilty, and when they saw those spots, three of those four jurors changed their votes. From that, you can conclude, I think, that the reason that they changed their votes was because they thought it was blood, and they thought it was Jason Brown's blood.
I see. Well, let me ask your help then interpreting the record in a similar fact or issue situation that has to do with the crying of the juror. You remember that the juror was crying, and then the juror was brought back, and then 606B became operative there as well, right?
I think it's operative at that point. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you just about the specific exchange that took place, because she was asked, what were they yelling at you for? She says, to change my verdict. And then the question is this reason that you were crying when you came into the courtroom because you had done that? In other words, change your verdict. She says, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that's proper under Rule 606B. But I would say the court should consider whether a rule of evidence can deprive a defendant of a unanimous verdict. If the juror has a guilty conscience and wants to come in and say, I was coerced, that becomes
an
enormous policy argument as to whether or not, what's the policy of the rule and whatnot. But I don't think you need to go that far because I was going to argue to the ICA that what Judge Kim should have done was call the juror up when he admits that he saw her crying. He admits that he saw her put her head down and wait a long time before she said yes. Yes, it was her verdict, but it wasn't her verdict based on her belief that Mr. Pitts was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It was her verdict because she was being yelled at and being humiliated, and that's why she changed her vote. So if Judge Kim had called her up to the bench at that point, Miss Juror, you know, you were crying when you came into court. You took a long time to answer yes. Was your vote was guilty, but was it based on your finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? She would have said no.
And you don't think that would have been an inquiry into her deliberative process?
I don't think that violates the rule at that point. And that's the Maryland case that I cited had said something similar. When the response is ambiguous, the court should, inquire as to the reason for the ambiguous response.
Yes, the case I think you're referring to is the Lattiso case, yes, where the juror said yes with reluctance,
yes,
and then the case was reversed because the court found that this expression of reluctance, along with, I guess, emotion, yes, she was upset, was an indication that this may not have been a voluntary verdict.
Correct, yes.
Can I come back to the pants? Your belief is that the bag was already open. Was it misconduct for them to take the pants out and look at them? Okay, so what was the misconduct?
The misconduct was in making the instructions talk about circumstantial evidence and things that you can infer, right? Make reasonable inferences. And a reasonable inference from those spots is not that is Mr. Brown's blood. It's not a reasonable inference because you need to have expert testimony.
But isn't that sort of second guessing the judgment of the jury? I mean, so
no.
Basically, if I understand your position, they could take the pants out and look at them, but they reached a conclusion based on that examination that you think is unreasonable in light of the evidence.
Yes, and violating their, the instructions. And their oath.
Isn't there a problem in the jury acquiring information outside of the evidence that was presented in this case, that wasn't presented in accordance with the rules? In other words, they have been exposed and given information, which are those three stains that they find, that didn't come through evidentiary rules and establish there being an appropriate foundation for its admission. You could never have admitted it that genes generated it.
If the defense had known those spots were there, they would have objected to it. Yeah? I mean...
Well, not only that, I mean, there'd have to be a foundation.
Yeah.
The same way that they...
Right.
They would have established a foundation when they introduced
the blood. You need to have expert testimony to say this is blood, and you need to have expert testimony to say this is Mr. Brown's blood. That's all. And so beyond that, it's just some irrelevant brown spots inside the pants.
But absent the testimony, how... Your argument is we know they looked at the pants, and then we can get into the testimony about what their votes were before versus their votes after without, and that based on that, there's an inference that they relied on something that was not properly in evidence or wouldn't support the inference that they apparently drew?
Yes, I think so, yes.
Mr. Kennedy, where's the statement in the transcript about what the votes were before and what the votes were after?
Oh, my goodness. Well,
I mean, there were three of us who felt that, and then it was cut off. And then I'm not saying it's not there, I just don't recall seeing that.
Okay, well, I can't cite to it right off the top of my head, and
Does it make a difference if it's just one or that fact that...
Yeah. I'm not talking about whether or not there's new evidence or anything. I'm just asking you about what you stated, that's all.
Yeah. Well, it's in there somewhere.
All right.
Do we even need to get into that, though? I think it's pretty clear under our case law of State versus Kim, you know, if there's juror misconduct, and juror misconduct can be coercion or bullying, but putting aside that, if there's juror misconduct, it appears... to me that a juror bringing in evidence that was not received during the trial is misconduct under our rules, and then under State versus Bailey, then we have to determine whether or not that's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt and whether it may have reasonably contributed.
But the state argues that was evidence that was admitted, okay, because
no,
the
but
were admitted.
But testimony, said, testimony yeah. that this is the victim's blood
yes, needed
is not, was not received.
Right. Yes.
That the victim's blood was on the inside of the pants was not received in evidence during the trial.
That's my
and
point.
Subject to cross-examination, the right to confrontation, right. His constitutional rights are violated.
That's my point.
Do you want to address the proposition that this actually is harmless error because there was a witness who saw the defendant get out of the car?
He didn't see the defendant get out of the car, okay? He saw the defendant go into the car to get his jacket out, and he saw the defendant go down to Kaiser's. He did not see the defendant get out of the car.
And why wouldn't that be sufficient to overcome the error?
Pitt's testimony was that after the attack, after the Brown ran up the street, he went back to the car, got his jacket out, and went down to Kaiser's. So he doesn't deny that was him that Igawa saw. And just denies that it was him who made the attack. And Igawa did not see who made the attacker. And he didn't see through the back of the window. He couldn't identify anybody. So that identification, well, first of all, that identification was suppressed by Judge Kim. That was part of the inadmissible evidence that the prosecutor was relying on. But that would be harmless error because later on Pitts comes and admits that was me. I went back to the car. I got my jacket out, and I went down to Kaiser, okay? So that would be harmless error, but it was ruled inadmissible by Judge Kim, and the prosecutor tried all kinds of ways.
Didn't Nagawa say there was a struggle that he observed going on in the car and somebody throwing punches?
Yeah, he did see a struggle, and he heard. He says he's heard noise, and he heard and saw a struggle and shaking of the car.
Couldn't that support an inference that that person was, in fact, Pitts, contrary to his version? He didn't ID him as a person, but he indicated.
He also said when Brown ran up the street, this is happening, he slumped down in the car. Okay, that's where our theory is. That's when the attacker got out, because he was down, slumped down under the seat, and he couldn't see what was going on at that point. And he gets up again after Brown is gone, and he sees. And he sees Pitts going back into the car. And, you know, he wasn't wearing the jacket.
And Mr. Egawa never, he was looking through the back window of the car, the red car.
Yeah.
So I guess you're, and he said he could just see there was someone in the stabbing him.
Yes.
But he couldn't identify Mr. Pitts at that point in time.
Right.
And then you're saying there was a lapse.
Yeah.
And in between.
While he was crouched down, and he admitted that he wasn't watching.
Can you address the, you were starting with prosecutorial misconduct, we switched you from there.
Yeah. I was going to go
can
through.
Can you discuss the apology testimony?
Apology testimony. Oh, that was ruled inadmissible, yeah?
It was ruled inadmissible.
In the motion in limine. That's another part of the very, very serious prosecutorial misconduct. And in fact, Judge Kim said you have to have evidence that he was made this demand for an apology before the attack, and there was no evidence of that. And that's the reason Judge Kim said it's inadmissible.
But there was no objection, correct, at the time that testimony came out. It wasn't until the next day that Mr. Pitts expressed concern. Is that correct?
The testimony about
the apology.
Okay. Judge Kim actually did stop the witness, okay, at that time. And this is even in the prosecution's answering brief.
My question is, was there... There was at that point, Judge Kim then advised, did the Judge Kim advise the jury to ignore?
No, here's what happened. It's on page 20. It's in my brief. It's also on page 23 of the answering brief. After you were discharged from the hospital and the defendant is out, and you two have a long history, long friendship. At any point, do you talk to the defendant after he's released? Brown, yeah, a couple days later, which is when I found out, you know, why. When I found out why. He wasn't supposed to say that. Okay, let me just direct your questioning here. So you talked to him. Did you ever ask him why he stabbed you? Brown, you know. And then Judge Kim interrupts. Wait. Mr. Brown, just answer the question. You answer yes or no. That's where he's enforcing his ruling. And then the follow-up. Answer is yes. You ask him, why did you stab me? Answer, right. And did he respond? His response was, all I wanted was an apology. I'm sorry, can you? All I wanted is an apology. Okay? That's a big difference. What I wanted was an apology. What I wanted is an apology.
So are you saying that the transcript is wrong? I don't understand what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the prosecutor was trying to establish that it happened before the attack by telling the guy he should say wanted. And then he forgot and said is. You know, she wanted him to say...
Oh, that's not a...
Huh?
You're saying that because the... You're saying that because the witness said, quote, his response was, all I wanted was an apology, that's a logical inference that the prosecutor tried to basically suborn perjury?
Yes. Uh-huh. He says, the crucial question is, did he want that apology before the attack? And the first answer is he said, I wanted an apology. Then a minute, 2 seconds later is all I want is an apology. Why don't you just apologize? So that's what he told you when you asked him, why did you stab me?
But wasn't all this stricken from the record by the court the next day? In other words, the next day Mr. Pitts came back, and please correct me if I misunderstand, came in, began expressing concern to the court, and the court then agreed to instruct the jury. All testimony yesterday from Mr. Brown having to do with this testimony that the defendant, Mr. Pitts, was in contact with him after the stabbing in this case, demanding an apology for something is stricken from the record. I'm striking it from the record. Anything to do with this alleged policy, you are to disregard.
Okay.
Now, why does that not factor into our assessment of whether this is grounds for vacating the conviction?
That would factor in, yes. But it wasn't immediate. Okay. It was.
And our law says that even though you consider that, sometimes a cautionary instruction is insufficient. We've said that. In several cases, and some recently.
But what I'm most concerned about is down below, you know what he did, what you did, just apologize. So before you picked up the defendant, did you know why he was mad at you? There's no evidence that he was mad at Mr. Pitt, and the witness says so. I didn't know he was mad at me.
Very well.
So, you know, basically, the prosecutor is testifying that Mr. Pitts was mad at the guy before he attacked him. She's giving her own statement of evidence. I guess my time is up.
Yeah. Chimes out. I will, if you could wrap up that thought, and let's hear from Ms. McCullough.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well.
May it please the Court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Sonia McCullen, on behalf of the State of Hawaii. It appears that this Court is concerned with the jury deliberations, and however, we should also be concerned with defense counsel's conduct in finding this information. He contacted the female juror, and Mr. Shum himself stated he Googled and did a people search for this female juror. He called her on his phone, or her phone, left a message, and when the juror called back, they discussed the deliberations.
Is this the place to complain about that, though?
It is. HRPC Rule 8.5 says this court is the authority.
Right.
And when we're looking at HRPC Rule 3.5.
Are these arguments you made in your brief?
Well, no, because 8.5 says this court's the authority, and so it wasn't until the case was transferred and oral argument was called, there really was no opportunity.
But was this raised? This issue was raised in the trial court, correct?
It was, and the trial court said he's not the authority.
Okay, and did you appeal that determination?
No, the state did not.
Okay.
Because your argument is that we are the authority.
But
this isn't the avenue. Wouldn't the violation of HRPC go to Office of Disciplinary Counsel and come up through there?
Yes, it could, or it normally does. But what the state is asking here is that this court, because of this violation...
I'm sorry, what rule was violated?
3.5 E42. And that rule prohibits lawyers from communicating with jurors regarding the trial except upon leave of the court. And there's also there's the statute HRS 612-13, which requires redaction of the jurors' phone numbers and addresses from the jury information.
I'm trying to understand, what are you arguing for? Are you arguing we should disregard this issue, disregard What exactly relief do you seek at this time? Please listen. What relief do you seek?
That the defendant should be precluded from raising any issue that stems from this improper conduct.
Very well. I think we understand that argument. And if you want to move, unless you have more to say about that, perhaps move on to your other points. But your argument is because of what you
consider misconduct.
A misconduct by the defense counsel, we should not address this issue, correct?
We should not, yes.
Okay, very well.
And if I could, really quickly, the purpose of this rule is to preserve freedom of deliberation, provide stability and finality of verdicts, and protect jurors from annoyance and embarrassment, and that's exactly what the defense counsel did here, subject her to annoyance. And the conversation with Mr. Shum, she called the deputy and said she was scared, confused, she felt threatened and harassed.
Is this all in the record too?
Yes, it is.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ms. McCullen, but let's assume that Mr. Shum had followed what I think is your well-considered advice, which is to go to the court and say, this is a juror who was crying, and this is a juror that seemed to have hesitation. And therefore, I would request the opportunity to contact the juror. Would you feel that the court would have a basis, especially knowing now what the information was, to have granted that request?
According to Mr. Shum, that wasn't the only reasons he wanted to talk to this juror. Apparently, a friend of Mr. Pitt's came up later and said that this juror had talked to her and told her that she believed he was innocent or something to that effect.
So is it your position then that the judge should have precluded Mr. Shum from contacting the juror?
If he properly requested? Well, I don't, yes, the court shouldn't allow Mr. Shum to contact the juror. They call the juror in for an in-court statement.
Well, then I guess Mr. Shum would be in contact with the juror, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Through the court.
So in any case, in your view, given the evidence that you see, there was a justified basis to inquire of the juror.
Based on Mr. Shum's proffer, the judge would probably be obligated to investigate the circumstances.
Then if you could respond to the Ladislaw case that we discussed earlier. The Ladislaw case is a case where the Maryland court found that the judge had abused his discretion by not following up where the juror had said yes, but then paused and was emotional and refused to follow up at the request of the attorney. Because in this case, we don't have a juror that's saying yes. We have a juror that indicated that she was being yelled at because she was voting in a manner that I guess the record would reflect would indicate not guilty. And then she was upset, and then when she was asked whether that's why she changed her vote, she says yeah. So that would seem to give even more of a basis to be concerned that perhaps the juror had not made a decision that was voluntary. So given that fact, why wouldn't it apply in this case? In other words, for the trial judge, to have determined that a mistrial should be granted?
Based on her testimony during the November 9th, 2016 hearing?
Yes.
Well, the November 9th, 2016 hearing was on the motions for a new trial, and the motions for a new trial was for prosecutorial and jury misconduct. The juror misconduct motion focused solely on the genes and not on yelling or coercion. And so that, I don't think, was before Judge Kim when Juror Owana testified.
Are you saying that Judge Kim, based on this record, should not have granted a mistrial, given the Ladislaw case?
Yes.
I mean, is it because of the procedural posture of the case, or is it just because you don't think Ladislaw applied?
Well, one, it's not precedent for this jurisdiction. It's not binding. And two, Judge Kim found no misconduct.
Oh, yes. I understand that because on appeal before us, it seems that that's been an issue that's been raised. So that's why I was inquiring as to why this case wouldn't have be a basis for finding that Judge Kim erred, since you have a juror crying and she indicates that she was changing her verdict because she was being yelled at.
Are you saying that it wasn't raised below?
It wasn't raised in the motion for new trial.
It wasn't raised in the written motion.
In the written motion. What happened was during the testimony of Juror Juana, which was supposed to be on the jeans, it appears that Mr. Shum then kind of did a fishing expedition. First, he asked questions about her comments to that person, that woman sitting, Mr. Pitts' friend, I believe. And then he asked questions about James Igawa and whether she believed him and if why she didn't report to the judge that she knew him. And so it was kind of a fishing expedition. And then he brought up the yelling and by the other juror. And so, but what was before Judge Kim in the motion for new trial, the written, was the jeans.
And what's your position or what's your response to Mr. Shetley's argument that, you know, again, I'm trying to understand first, was it misconduct for them to open the bag and look at the jeans, and how far can we go in considering the testimony about what was going through the discussions of the jurors? How do we analyze that issue in the state's view?
It's a little multi-layered here. So in terms of opening the bag, we have Ms. Sunaoka's testimony, and she testified that she opened up the bag, took out the jeans, raised it up, gave the size number, folded or put it back. And then we have the jury communication, which
said... So that's a testimony at trial?
Yes, testimony at trial. Do you want the...
No, I think we can find it. So she took a photograph? She held them up to examine them?
The jeans. She explained that she opened up the bag before she entered the courtroom at that moment, and then she pulled out the jeans, held it up for the jury. She looked at the size number, said it was size 40, and then she put it back. So at that point, we know the jeans are open, or the bag in which the jeans were placed was open. And then we have the jury communication number one, which says is asking for gloves and notes the bag is open. So as to, I agree with Mr. Shetty that there's no evidence in the 2010 record of scissors and them actually physically opening the bag.
Okay, now was it improper for them to take the jeans out and examine them?
It was proper. It was admitted, the jeans were admitted into evidence. There was no objection. It's the judge's discretion as to whether the physical evidence goes to the jury room. The jeans was used to show ID, what the defendant was wearing, and the fact that the pants were big. They're size 40s. And testimony was that he was pulling it up. So it was very relevant, and it was not an abuse of discretion for the judge to send it back there. Once it's back there, it's proper for the jurors to examine it, and that's what they did.
And Mr. Shetley acknowledges that, though.
Yeah.
He agrees it was proper, not improper.
So what about... How far down the road do we go of listening to or giving, you know, how much of the testimony that came in? I think Mr. Shetley would say testimony about what the jurors thought shouldn't come in, but, and I don't mean to mischaracterize it, Mr. Shetley, but I think he would say we know that they took the bag out, you know, they were at a certain place or certain jurors were apparently looking at an acquittal, took the bag out. Took the jeans out, looked at them, and shortly thereafter voted guilty. Is that something that we can give weight to?
And I think we need to look at her testimony very carefully. On page 24 of the transcript, the November 9th transcripts in 2016, she says they were looking for blood on line 19. And then if we go to page 26, line 22, Mr. Shum asks, do you believe or did you see any stains on the pants? She answers, just small drops, and they determined that it must be blood. He starts to ask the next question. So this is where they determine, the They thought it was blood. Came in or
What page are you in again?
I'm sorry. Was 26.
Yep.
Okay. At the very bottom, line 24. And then the next page, there's an objection. And the next two pages, or page and a half, Mr. Pitts has an outburst. There's a little commotion in the courtroom. And after everything settles down on page 28, line 12, the judge says, ask that question again, because there was an objection that I did not get to, or didn't get. And if you can't, move on to another question. And so Mr. Shum asks the question again. When you turned the pants inside out, did you see any stains on them or any coloring that was caused you to have suspicions? She answers, three small, little, tiny, minute, I don't know what to call them, stains. That's about it. And then if we turn to page 30, line 4, the question is, did you have a belief as to what these spots were? She answers, I don't know what they were. So there was an objection to the blood, that they determined it must be blood. So technically that's not in evidence.
Well, doesn't she?
Because he re-asked the question and she didn't restate it. She said she doesn't know what they are.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but wasn't there the question asked, do you believe or did you see any stains on the pants? Answer, just small drops, and they determined that it must be blood.
That's what I'm saying was objected to, and the court said re-ask the question. Mr. Shum re-asked the question.
Well, that may well be that. Okay, maybe the question was re-asked, but I'm referring to the answer that was actually given that's in the record, where she says, just small drops, and they determined that it must be blood. I mean,
I understand
maybe there's a need to follow up and ask more questions, but
it's not really in evidence because the question had to be re-asked, and she never restated that.
If the question's re-asked, the prior answer to a prior question is not admissible?
If there's an objection, but what happened is
there was no objection.
He said, I didn't get it because there was an outburst, and so he asked the counsel to re-ask it so he could rule.
That may be, but I don't see a ruling that says that her answer was either stricken from the record or that the answer was
it seems to me
inadmissible.
The court made findings, and the court's findings were that the jurors observed three small stains on the pants, and we have to find that finding is harmless beyond reasonable doubt in a case like this where the jury finds it necessary to look for blood.
Well, I think first we need to find that itself was misconduct.
Can I finish my question?
Oh, sure.
I mean, the question is, I think this term about misconduct is a little bit not helpful. It's maybe even inartful. The question is whether the jury has been given access to information that didn't go through the proper evidentiary channels. Now, whether that information comes through experiments, whether it comes through a juror orally saying something, whether it comes through an item being in a wallet or a dictionary being there or a juror going outside and looking at an experiment in series, it really comes down to is exposure to information that hasn't been properly admitted. And as Justice McKenna noted, that hasn't been subjected to cross-examination, that hasn't been given the normal way that evidence is introduced against the defendant.
I agree that we can't just put in anything that, like blood stains and say, or stains and have the jurors assume it's blood or without expert witnesses to verify it and whatnot. But what happened here was the genes were admitted into evidence. And according to State v. Joseph, it's both parties' attorneys' responsibility to check, make sure there's no inappropriate items being submitted.
And like, didn't Joseph go on and say, if I remember correctly, that because the defense didn't know about it, we find no waiver? And there's no question in this case, looking at the defendant's closing argument, the fact that he was pro se and all these other things, that he had no knowledge whatsoever that there were three stains. Nobody.
I don't think anybody knew it,
exactly,
according to the record. But that the jury looked at it. So in order to show substantial prejudice, we have to show two things. One, misconduct, and one, or two, that let me make sure I get the correct wording, that the comment was used as a circumstance against the defendant. And we, although we know that the actual looking at the genes, examining the genes, is not misconduct, but seeing three spots in the inside, I don't think that's misconduct either. It was how the genes were submitted. But let's even assume we say it's misconduct, that they saw these spots. I'm not sure we can say, without that testimony, that it was used as a circumstance against him. And even if we are able to meet those two criteria, then we go to harmless.
Isn't the burden on you? Hasn't our court said? I mean, what the court could have done was get the other three jurors and ask all the jurors, did any of you look at any of this? Did this, in other words,
well, Juana already testified.
This is what our case law requires.
The case law requires an investigation as to the totality of the circumstances. And the court heard Juror Juana's testimony. Her testimony was that they looked at these genes, the inside. Was it necessary to call other jurors in? We have her testimony already saying that they looked at it. And the court cannot ask these other jurors if he does ask you, did you look at it, and they say yes. He can't ask them, did that affect your verdict?
And he
could also ask, however, did you hear the statement, this is blood or this must be blood?
He could ask that, yes.
And aren't we in the statement, a situation like Williamson? And Williamson, they didn't even know if any of the jurors had looked at the dictionary. But just the fact that some juror had brought in the dictionary and the potential that they could have looked up the definitions of entrapment and the other word in that case, same situation here. The potential that we know the jurors looked at the stains, the potential that it could have been utilized in a way that they assumed it was blood, that's sufficient.
Well, it could have been, there's a couple ways it could have been utilized, I guess. It could have been utilized as assuming it was Brown's blood, and if they did that, it would be harmless because we already have physical evidence of Brown's blood on one of Mr. Pitt's clothing. And if they used it as evidence, it could have been used as evidence to prove or to show that Mr. Pitt was at one time at the bloody car, and we already have direct testimony or direct evidence of that. And so again, it would be harmless.
Perhaps you may want to respond to the prosecutorial misconduct.
Okay.
Allegations.
There's four allegations. Which most concerns you, I guess?
What about the tailoring? If you'd start with that, the suggestion that there was improper tailoring argument made here, based either on his presence in the courtroom or his review of the evidence,
The challenge statement is, now the defendant does not have to put on the case at all. It's the state's burden. After looking at all the facts, after looking at the police reports and the evidence that's in this case, the defendant comes up with an idea. It wasn't me. It was somebody else. I didn't do this. The state's comment seems to refer to evidence in general. And we know that defendant requested his files, and so the reasonable inference is that he looked at them.
Well, wait.
And it's not.
When you say we know he looked, was that admitted at trial that he requested to look at the police reports?
It's in the transcripts that he requested from Mr. Shum all his files.
That's not what I'm asking. Was it a trial issue? Was it admitted to the jury?
No.
So the prosecutor is telling them things that wasn't introduced. And not only telling them things that wasn't introduced, it's drawing an inference that it's wrong to do that, and that based on looking at it, that's how he created his defense. And that's okay.
I don't think she's saying it's wrong. I mean, it's natural that anyone preparing a defense would look at everything, would look at their reports, would look at would look at everything they can to prepare for this defense.
Ms. McCullen, isn't the point of error on appeal that it's a comment on the defendant's right to be present?
Present, yes. And that was never specifically stated. But even if we interpreted it as such, it wasn't solely that. Because she discussed the testimony of Brown. The state also discussed the testimony of Igawa. So it's discussing specific evidence.
I'm a little unclear. Is it your position that once the prosecution presents its case, that it can argue in closing argument that the reason that the defendant eventually testified the way the defendant did was because the defendant listened to the prosecution's case and changed the facts to be able to refute the government's case? That's the proper argument?
That he changed the facts?
Sometimes no, it's called tailoring, but the argument would be in closing that the defendant tailored the facts, tailored the argument, changed the facts, manipulated the facts after listening to the government's case.
No, that's
is it
not
your
proper.
View? Okay. Well, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. I thought you were saying that because he sat through the case.
No, what she said was he, after looking at all the facts, after looking at the police reports and the evidence that's in this case, I mean, that's what a defense does, is look at all the evidence to present their defense. But she's not saying that because he sat there, he tailored it.
Why bring that up?
Why wouldn't that be tailoring if she said it's based on after reviewing all the evidence in this case? The evidence is up until the point he testifies. So why isn't that tailoring?
Because he's not making it up to fit what he heard.
He comes up with this defense. How is that not tailoring?
It's not specific tailoring based on his presence at trial. She's saying it's based on a review of everything.
And why is she bringing it up then? What's her point if it's not to say that the defense's testimony has been adjusted based on what the defendant heard from the prosecution? Well, what's the purpose of bringing it up?
I disagree that that's what she's saying. She's
okay,
saying
I accept that you disagree. I'm just asking your help to explain why would she bring it up then?
Well, I don't know why she, I mean, it's part of her.
What about violations of motions in limine?
Oh, okay, so the court excluded defendant accusing Jamie Lyons of raping or sleeping with his girlfriend, Caitlin Thompson. He also excluded defendant accusing Brown of sleeping with his girlfriend, having a certain amount of time to apologize.
Well, what about, okay, what about his prior conviction? Wasn't that excluded?
I'm sorry, I don't recall.
In terms of, he could refer to the theft arrest and conviction, but could not refer to the theft as a crime of dishonesty.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to answer. Was that raised?
I thought it was.
I'm sorry, I'm not prepared.
Let's ask about, if I could ask you about the apology. So looking at the court's ruling on the motion in limine, wouldn't it appear that the prosecuting attorney was precluded from going into the issue of the apology? And if so, do we then need to analyze whether that misconduct was harmless, if it were misconduct?
If I recall her questions, it didn't go into Jamie Lyons, it didn't go into Brown sleeping with defendant's girlfriend, or the threats against Brown's father. She did ask, and one of his responses was apology, and she did go into that a little, but the court then struck it.
Wasn't that precluded?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was precluded as to the amount of time he had to apologize.
I think even at the hearing, the prosecutor acknowledged, and again, this wasn't only a motion in limine from the defense. As I recall, the state actually made an affirmative notice of intent to utilize it. The judge not only denied it, but precluded it. And as I understand our evidentiary rules under 103, once it's precluded under a motion in limine, there's not even necessary to object.
Yeah.
So the fact that there was no objection is irrelevant because this court had specifically excluded it. And despite that, there's extensive testimony. And
I don't know about extensive.
Well,
there were times,
I think, the word apology. And isn't that perhaps the most significant issue in the case as to whether or not was a motive?
And then the court struck it the next day, and the jury is presumed to follow those instructions. The court gave, not only struck it, but told them not to consider anything to do with an apology. And he explained because he didn't want speculation. So if it was misconduct, it should be harmless.
And you acknowledge that our cases have indicated that in certain situations, a curative instruction may not be sufficient.
Yeah, and I don't think this is one of them. I think there's no evidence that the presumption is the jury follows the instructions, and I don't think there's evidence that they didn't follow it as to the apologies.
Oh. I don't think we actually look for evidence. We look to see the nature of the harm, the potential harm.
I mean, your view, this isn't one of those sort of cat out of the bag situations where what was put in front of the jury was so harmful that even though they're instructed to ignore it, that they're going to be unable to, they would have been unable to put that out of their mind?
No, I'm confident. I mean, I don't feel that it was something that would have prejudiced the defendant.
Didn't Mr. Shetley argue that even the grand jury was struggling with why Mr. Pitts would stab Mr. Brown?
Yes.
Well, if the grand jury was struggling with it, isn't that an indication that motive is missing? And if the grand jury's thinking about it, and as Mr. Shetley says, the Pettit jury then would be wondering the same thing too. What's the motive? So wouldn't that be providing a key element that finders of fact may be struggling with?
I'm sure they wanted maybe more information as to why, what was going on. But there was a lot of testimony about drugs and that Mr. Pitts was high. I think jurors can make reasonable inferences. If there's no further questions, I'd like to conclude that there was no prosecutorial or juror misconduct here, and that the misconduct here was really in defense counsel's contacting the juror the way he did. And we shouldn't be considering we should be precluding any issues that stem from that improper contact.
Your position is that we should do that even though that particular issue wasn't appealed, because it was raised in the trial court. My understanding,
yes.
There was a motion actually filed about that issue by the DPA, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, which the judge said, I'm not going down that road.
I believe there's case law that says an appellee, the state as an appellee in a criminal case, can raise new issues. And so if this court considers it a new issue, it could be raised here.
Basically, it appears what you're really asking this court to do is adopt like a fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine to preclude any evidence adduced by defense counsel in violation of rules of professional conduct to inure in the defendant's favor.
Well, kind of, because we don't want to put our stamp of approval in this kind of behavior to let defendants or anyone know that the end would justify the means and we should go on these fishing expeditions, we should be harassing jurors. We shouldn't.
So it wouldn't violate the Constitution. So even if we found out somebody was innocent, and even though a lawyer had neglected to ask the court first to get permission to contact the juror, then even if it disclosed the person was innocent, as far as you're concerned, we should just look the other way and just say, too bad, you shouldn't have contacted the juror.
Well, I wouldn't go, and we don't know that yet. He was found, in your hypothetical, he's found, or that person is found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt at that point. And there should be other avenues besides attorneys or litigants contacting jurors after the fact.
Thank you.
Very well, thank you. Mr. Shetley, we had used your time. I gave Ms. McCullen a little extra time, so if you could do a brief rebuttal, though, I would ask that you keep your remarks brief.
All right. I think Justice Pollack's point it just made was an excellent point. Why do you punish the defendant for his lawyer's supposed misconduct, even if Mr. Shum was guilty of misconduct? There are the remedies are against Mr. Shum, not against Mr. Pitts. We know what we know, okay? As far as a issue of coercion being raised.
What about Ms. McCullough's argument that it's putting our imprimatur on misconduct if we allow it to be used? So attorneys will risk it to just help their client, but
I don't see that he can't still be sanctioned, yeah? I mean, he could.
No, but would it encourage that kind of conduct, though?
To put somebody into jail because their lawyer didn't engage in misconduct?
No, what her argument was, you were right here, was that it would encourage defense attorneys to contact jurors when they shouldn't.
I don't see
if we don't say that
don't,
that's...
I don't see how that does. I mean, the proper procedure, as Chief Justice pointed out, is against the attorney. Yeah? I mean, that's the way you discourage attorneys from doing improper things. And besides which, there needs to be some kind of more factual... This is the first I've heard of this, okay? So I wasn't even... I'm not prepared to discuss or argue this point, but it just got raised. It wasn't raised in the brief, so... But the way it should be raised is in a disciplinary council, and there should be some, Mr. Shump should have an opportunity to defend himself, and it should come out of what happened, what was done, and whether it was proper or not proper. It shouldn't be done here.
And you're saying that the ODC process would be enough to discourage that kind of behavior by an attorney?
I think so, yes. And the other point was coercion was not raised. Mr. Pitts raised the issue of coercion before the first appeal in a motion for new trial that he's filed by himself pro se. It wasn't in the second. It wasn't in the written motion after remand, but the evidence did come out at the hearing of coercion, and it was. And it was just argued, but
are you talking about coercion by members of the jury to other members?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mr. Pitts raised that in a pro se motion for a new trial before the first appeal. Okay, Mr. Shum did not raise it in the first motion for a new trial after the remand, or even in the amended motion. But it did come out in the testimony, as we noticed.
So he raised it before the hearing on the motion for new trial in which the juror testified, though.
He raised it after the trial before the first appeal, for asking for a new trial. He didn't, that's after he fired Shum the first time. Now, I wonder if we could, you just made a 75-page opinion Monday about juror misconduct. I was wondering if a supplemental memoranda would be appropriate to discuss.
If the court concludes that there is any need for that, we'll let you know. I at this point, I don't expect that we would, but if we come to that conclusion, we'll let you know. Anything further at this point, Mr. Shetley? Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
E ku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku iomai ne kea aha ho'oku kie kie hano hano okamoku aino o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.